Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. It's a pleasure being back with you once again. It is getting late here over in Northern Idaho. It's getting close to midnight, but for our guest, it's early in the morning over in Sweden. The Golden One joins us here today, and he's back on the show. It was a while ago since we talked to him, and if you're not familiar with him, just a quick introduction here. He's probably best known kind of for his, you know, fitness and I'd say motivational work even. He's done stuff on mythology and, you know, European stories and things like that, but he's deeply entrenched, of course, in the political scene, I would say, as well. There's the spectacle, really, that's unfolding in Europe right now, across the West. He's making videos, he posts on these kinds of topics. He's the author of the book Dauntless as well, which I don't think was out when we spoke to him last time. He has a clothing line, he has a line of supplements and kind of fitness-related products as well, so he's been busy since we last spoke. Now, I want to let him in on a little thing here, too. He has two daughters now. Congratulations, Marcus, by the way. We'll get to that. I think when we spoke last time, I think maybe mine was Rurik. He was like 2 years old. Or Rurik, as I would say in Swedish. Mm-hmm. He was 2 years old. But now we have two boys and we have one girl. And Marcus, I realized last time we talked back and forth a little bit, we have the same name for our daughter, Sigrid. I didn't know you picked that name, and I'm not sure you know that I picked that name. It's funny, but I think we picked it independently of a child, which shows that it's a superior name, obviously, right? We can fight about the dates here, but I think my Sigurd might be like 1 month older than your Sigurd, maybe? I'm not sure.
Yeah, ours came in early May, so probably.
Oh, it's that recent. That's right. Okay, yeah, there you go. So four months older, I think, then. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, congratulations, fatherhood.
Thank you.
Good
and
stuff.
Likewise.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it is.
How does it feel?
It feels good. She started to smile and even laugh now, so it's quite magical. It's, of course, a bit of a change of pace getting a second daughter, but it's you know, when you get that feedback, as it were, when she starts recognizing you, it's absolutely magical. So a lot of work, of course, maybe a few nights with suboptimal sleep, it's worth it.
It doesn't last forever, you know what I mean?
Doesn't
last forever. It's a precious time and it will disappear. But all right, it's good to be back with you once again. I might ask you a little bit later, by the way, if, you know, fatherhood. Maybe there's some tips out there for the guys you have and so forth. But there's just a how do we say this in a nice way? I don't think we can. It's been a shit show in Europe since we last spoke. It's slowly getting worse and worse. That's just the reality of it. We're slowly getting more. You know, we're slowly getting replaced with more and more migrants. Our borders getting open. The LGBTQ push has accelerated to an incredible rate in the West since we last spoke as well. And we've had, you know, just mention a few of them, like a recent few attacks. We had one, of course, in Sweden. That wasn't a stabbing, by the way. That was a shooting. Farsta. I think that's just outside of Stockholm. Three people.
Yeah, there's plenty of shootings. I mean, plenty. The entire Stockholm area. It's it's not only one, it's I don't even know how many, but yeah, the situation is quite severe.
It is severe.
A lot more so than last time we spoke, and even back then the situation was quite bad, but now it's escalated quite a bit, I would say.
It has. We have that in Sweden, just one of the recent ones, right? But we have in Nottingham, we had the stabbing there too. By an African. In France, you had a Syrian, right? He was like running around on a playground, essentially, stabbing kids, children, sitting in strollers. It's absolutely insane. What do you feel about this when you see all of this stuff? I mean, you can kind of be angry up to a certain point, but then you realize you have to start channeling that anger. You have to make something kind of constructive out of that. Otherwise, it will just be blackpilling. It will just take you down. It will just be kind of turning into something negative, as opposed to like a fire in our asses that we need to be able to turn this stuff around. What do you feel when you see all this?
Yeah, so basically my overall attitude is... And I actually write about this in my upcoming book as well, about sort of propaganda. So you have, you know, the initial anger, which I suppose most of us, most of our audience now, we felt this initial anger many years ago. I certainly did. So now I've gotten to the stage where I try to, so I haven't watched any of these videos. There was a video from France again 2 days ago, I think. I didn't watch the video, but of course I knew only you know, I scrolled quickly past it on Twitter, but I shared the news itself. And my overall take is that it's good to share these videos with a segment of the population that hasn't perhaps yet been exposed to the nightmare of the Multicultural Hell Project. But if you are already on board, if you already know that the only thing that can save European civilization is a mass, it's a large-scale repatriation process, then it can be, you know, quite demoralizing and quite horrible to, I don't find a better word, it's quite horrible to see all of these things. I'm already on my path. I know what I'm doing. I'm trying to change the narrative, trying to set a high pace in the metapolitical, so we can change the Overton window. What you've been doing for a lot longer than I have, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm focusing on. So on a personal note, I don't need to see it, but it's also good to share these horror stories with individuals who perhaps haven't woken up, so to speak, yet. Because also that's something to point out, that in Sweden, for example, you've had a segment of the population, say men, well-off men in their 60s. They have gone to school in a homogenous Sweden. They've gone to work at a homogenous office, you know, with other Swedish men and maybe some, you know, German doctor or, you know, Greek engineer or whatever. So well-integrated Europeans. And they think, oh, look how well the Multicultural Project is working, because I have these nice immigrant friends and my doctor is from Iran. So they sort of don't know the backside of the story, this horror story. So I'd say it's good to still get the message out there about these things. But on a personal note, I try to limit this black pills. But yeah, so it's different for different people. But of course, I get angry, still get angry.
I think you have to be. I think it's inhuman not to. To not feel hate. I mean, there was like, look, the Nottingham thing, we talked about that in a prior show, but, you know, just to go into that a little bit, with three people there that were killed, and the mom, yeah, kind of as usual, the mom came out, let's not use this for hate, you know, of one of the victims there, and, you know, doing the usual spiel, and everybody is having their vigils and their thoughts and prayers and stuff like that, as opposed to actually getting to, like, well, how do we stop this? This is obviously not a singular kind of occurrence, right? So you get that, like, ethnomasochism, I guess, really the best word for it, where they continuously are kind of counter-signaling all of this. But we have to, I think the best way is to face that reality. We can't hide from that. And you know, oh, it hurts and stuff, and it's painful. But feeling hate is probably the most fundamental human emotion we can feel at things like that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I will say something here as well regarding, like, the mental game propaganda and how, you know, how we view ourselves. It is important to point out that whites are victims. I don't like to say this as a proud man myself. I don't like to view myself in that way. And for younger white men, it's very important to present them with images of them being victors. So for a certain segment of the population, so young white men primarily, they need to be in the mindset of still being capable and tough, so that they understand that they can fight and defend themselves. Because if they only see videos of white guys being beaten up by a group of others, that might put them in a constant state of, you know, them feeling like losers, and that will impact how they carry themselves. However, it's still important for most individuals, for most of the population, to understand that whites are victims. It pains me to say, but it's true, and it's something that we need to point out to everyone who wants to listen, that what is going on right now, be it in good old America or good old Europe or Australia, it's at the expense of white people. And it can be such a thing as a rape, a stabbing, a shooting, higher property costs. You know, young white couples don't have the money to buy property because it's being bought up by others. So first thing is to simply recognize that we are victims. Now, of course, on a personal note, on a personal level, this isn't something that you should, view yourself as, but it's important in our narrative. We need to say that, you know, this hell project, mass immigration, even the LGBTQ propaganda, it's something that is bad for us, and we are victims of said policies. That is the first step, in my view, to at least start to combat it via, you know, metapolitical and political measures. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. You don't want to blackpill too much. You don't want to expose yourself too much to your own side losing. Perhaps I've mentioned this before, but you can actually raise your testosterone by being on the winning side of a computer game. So if you play with five friends, you play Dota 2 or something, or whatever it might be, you win, you will get a small spike in testosterone. Now, it's very small, it is not significant, but it still shows that when you are on the winning side, same thing if you're watching a sports ball game, by the way, if your side wins, you get a rush of, still a small rush.
What if you play the game, like a sport? That's more, I would assume? Do you know?
Yeah. I don't know the exact amounts, but I know that you can either play, it can be a physical sport or even a computer game, and you can watch your side win. So when your mind interprets your own side as winning, then you will get a boost in confidence, basically. So that's also what I mean. If you're a young guy and you are already red-pilled, then it's more important for you to watch videos of, you know, other strong white men who are capable and who are doing stuff. But if you are an older woman or an older man, then it might be a good idea to awaken yourself to the horrible reality that that is facing many of our people.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I've got to say, too, I mean, we should blame, obviously, the people that are doing this, the perpetrators. They're not guiltless here. They obviously bear a huge responsibility. And in some cases, it's, oh, well, they're mentally ill or whatever. But the overarching issue here is, of course, we have hostile forces in our respective countries that have turned against their own people. And it's people like this with their refugees welcome campaigns and hashtags and stuff like that. I'd even include some of the organizations out there, you know, from Israel and the U.S., you have HIAS and things like that. There's many others, of course, tons of these NGOs. They're making money on it. They're digging into, you know, whether it's in the U.S., it's the federal trough, as they say. In Europe, there's other kind of grants that they're given, these organizations. So they're making money on it, and then they kind of can put themselves on the moral high horse at the same time. And look at how good I am, because I'm, like, advocating for the replacement of our people. But it's really people like this that I think... Look, we have to, of course, tackle the physical threat on the streets as well. So I'm not saying ignore that, but I'm saying a lot of the focus needs to be of trying to get to the root of the problem. These people, to a certain extent, are kind of just responding to impulses. It's just kind of how many of them are in their own countries as well. So we have to really try to pinpoint, well, who do we blame and how do we move forward and try to, like, you know, counteract this so we can turn it around? What do you think about this?
Yeah, definitely. So again, we have, you know, on the street level, so to speak, the advice we could give to young men and women who are still, they can't really escape Gotham City. So Gotham City is my catch-all phrase for, you know, a rundown Western city full of others and degeneracy and stuff like that. So on that level, it's of course a very immediate response they have to group up and train and everything like that. Situational awareness is the key. That is actually, if I could tell every white person on earth something, it would be just situational awareness. That's the number one key. But yeah, as you say, we need to get to the push and pull factors, especially on our side, the pull factors. So what is pulling all of these immigrants from the third world, what is pulling them towards our nations? And of course, to take a very real example from Sweden, and this became apparent in the last election, you have left-wing parties and they collaborate with the local imam of a certain place, a certain suburb to Stockholm. And by the way, for our American listeners here, a suburb in Sweden is something, it's something bad. A suburb is not something good. So förort in Swedish, it's a bad
euphemism for a diversity ghetto, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It is. So the suburbs, so they say to the local imam, okay, I'm just making an example here, based on real examples, but they say to the local imam, here you have a grant for a mosque. Can we count on all of your, you know, all of the ones who are under your influence? Can we count on them voting, all of them, for the leftist party, Vänsterpartiet, or the social democrats, or whatever it might be? So they have that sort of deal. And really fun thing here, or fun, I don't know if it's fun, but interesting, that they actually staged a coup in one of these suburbs recently, where they voted out the Swedish social democrats. So the originally corrupt politicians, to vote in whatever ethnicity it was. So the deal they have, or the unofficial deal, is that they give welfare and they get votes in return. So a very clear example is, you know, the left-wing parties importing individuals who will vote for them. So I'd say that highlighting that corruption, I suppose we can call it, highlighting that to the segment of the Swedish population that are still thinking that social democrats, so that's the original workers' party, they need to know that these guys, they are not on your side, they are not on the side of Swedish workers. And something to keep in mind here as well, for all non-Swedes, which majority of listeners, I suppose, that for old people, this is something a teacher once told me, that for old people, politics is religion. So for them, for an old working class man or woman to not vote for the Social Democrats, it's sort of like, yeah, converting to a different religion.
Right.
If you've been a Protestant Christian your entire life, and then when you're 70 years of age, you convert to Catholicism. So it's a big step. Now, of course, many older people, they have gone to the Sweden Democrats already, but this still, especially in the north of Sweden, which has always been very red, it is, it's a big step to take. And I think in exposing the corruption of the modern social democrats, because the social democrats, they did some good stuff back in the day when they were still concerned with the well-being of the Swedish population. But now, if we can just point that this is how they get their votes, they are not working for the benefit of the Swedish working class, if we can even say that there is such a thing as a Swedish working class. You know, we have a very big middle class in Sweden, and then now, of course, as of late, we have an imported proletariat, basically, which are the new darlings of the left. So they took the Swedish working class, threw out the window, replaced with people they can count on for votes, because these groups, these blocks of third world immigrants, they're of course dependent upon welfare grants as well. So it's, you give us votes, you give us welfare. So that is but one of many examples we can take.
Yeah, I mean, European politics overall, we do have some developments. I mean, we could stick in Sweden a little bit longer. Sweden Democrats did very well in the last election. Yeah. They're the second largest party now. Mm-hmm. And then they went into this kind of bizarre coalition of sorts, right, with the conservatives, the Christian Democrats. Is there another party in that mix?
Liberals,
which is kind of odd, right? Because it's not exactly the same liberals as in, you know, America think of. This is more economically oriented liberals. But hey, look, most of them are pro LGBTQ now. I mean, in that sense, they're still all liberal, right? But anyway, they went together. They're doing this new kind of basically, Sweden Democrats ends up kind of outside of the major roles, as if I'm representing this correct here, right? They do get important, like, ministerial positions and things like this, but there are a couple of other things that they're kind of left out on. But it seems that the moderate party, which of course the prime minister now, Ulf Kristersson, he's a prime minister, he's heading up the moderate party, or used to head up the moderate party, I'm not sure if they outmaneuvered the Sweden Democrats or how much power they have, but it looks like they kind of ended up on the sidelines a little bit, and not much have happened. I thought that they would have even more influence. What's your perception of this, Marcus?
So I'd say that there's been a lot of political intriguing, so Byzantine levels of intriguing in the political system now. So they have spent a lot of is wheeling and dealing, and I would say that the more visible positions have gone to the mainstream parties, so Moderaterna, Liberalerna, and Centerpartiet. No, not Centerpartiet. Sorry,
the Christian Democrats, right? Yeah,
yeah, Christian Democrats. Okay. But I would say that the Sweden Democrats, they have still managed to get some influential positions more behind the scenes, so to speak. So I do believe that the Sweden Democrats are playing it for the longer perspective. So I think they are quite secure in a growing amount of voters for every election. I mean, it's been a quite rapid rise for them. And to give an example of how fast things have gone, metapolitically speaking, over the last, say, 10, 13 years, I remember back in 2010. I will use an example from, I was at a university then in Uppsala, which is quite leftist. And I don't remember exactly how we got into it, but this was after the election. And I said it became clear that I had voted for the Sweden Democrats, and the room went like cold in an instant. Everyone was like very, very uncomfortable all of a sudden. It was fun. And of course, I wasn't a public figure. I was just a student giving my take on the situation. But the overall, perhaps you remember this as well, back in 2010, the Sweden Democrats, they were like the devil. The devil has gotten into the parliament, and the world will collapse. And yeah. Now, complete meltdown in basically all of Swedish society. Now, however, yeah, I mean, many people you meet, regular normies who 13 years ago, they would have never said anything critical of mass immigration. But now they can say, yeah, we need to start sending people back. We need to do this and that. And of course, I vote for the Sweden Democrats and stuff like that. So the Overton window might be hard to see from the outside. But if you followed the pulse of the Swedish metapolitical climate for some time, it's drastically shifted. And I do believe that these other parties, especially the moderates, they have gone quite far to the right as well, or far to the right. They're still liberals and everything like that. And we had a prime minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, and he must have hated Sweden. I can't imagine
he did.
Otherwise.
100%.
Yeah, hated the Swedish population. So he wanted to make Sweden into a mini America, just
Wasn't his grandfather like an African or something like that, or like he had some?
Yeah, he had some back.
Yeah, and he felt like he picked up on that, and maybe he didn't feel 100% Swedish. I'm not sure, but something was going on there.
Yeah, I'd say I think it was further back still, but okay. He had some non-Swedish in his background, and I do believe that made him not feel quite at home in Swedish society. He wanted to, like many others do, they want to make it into a melting pot.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing here with the moderates, I do believe that his, you know, insane policies, they were quite unpopular with many moderates, and they now see an opportunity to go back further, again, right, I mean, in a normal position. Now, of course, this Ulf Kristersson, in his youth, like many people were, he was a very, you know, pro-immigration, perhaps not libertarian, but very, very keen on these right-wing economic policies. And when I say right-wing, I mean that in the sense of, you know, free enterprise and stuff like that. But this guy now, and I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt now, perhaps he has seen this isn't working. We need to do something, because after all, I mean, these individuals, they live in Stockholm. They work in Stockholm. They have children going to school in Stockholm. They see shootings every other day. They see robberies, they see all manner of bad things. So, I mean, they can escape more than a normal Swedish family can, but it's still not an impossibility that bad things will happen to their families because of the policies they have supported. So, I mean, if I'm being generous here, I could say that many of these politicians, they, of course, they have pressure from outside, from the deep state or however we shall call it. But I still think that there is a will to sort of crack down upon the criminal gangs, at least. So perhaps they don't want to, you know, initiate a large-scale repatriation process, but I do believe that they want to, sincerely want to be a bit stricter, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm showing that article there. This was written by Ulf Kristersson, our prime minister, and it definitely ups the rhetoric a little bit, at least. I mean, the danger here is there's a lot of talking, and that could even be just a political, you know, Byzantine maneuvering, essentially, where they basically say, well, let's just steal popularity from the Sweden Democrats and deflect the whole situation, and let's erase the rhetoric but actually not do anything about it. That's, from my vantage point, that's the most likely thing that's going on right now. If they do something about it, great, right? But I saw people writing about this particular article from Aftonbladet. They were like, oh, you know, it doesn't work. They have to go back. There was like tweets seen a million times about that, you know, and of course that was misrepresented. He didn't say they have to. I wish he said they have to go back. No. He didn't. Yeah. He said it doesn't work, as you said. We need a comprehensive immigration reform. He did say that he wanted some of the strictest immigration policy in the EU, which is definitely a good start. But you have that. I still have that sense. I want to get your take on this, but I have this. There's this danger where they basically want to, integration doesn't work, right? So then they're thinking, okay, we have to just do it better, right? So that they can become part of us. They truly want these people to become Swedish, right? Even if they try to look like us or appear like us, at least, or fit in, you know, kind of act like us to a certain extent. And my feeling have always been, look, it's obviously bad if we have, like, essentially colonies in our countries of foreigners who are in there. But at least then, if they remain separate from us, I think where we want to take things, which, of course, let these people go back to their countries, this is obviously not working kind of thing, that's going to be very much easier if they're not very well integrated and embedded into our society kind of thing, right? And this guy is like, no, we need to do it right, essentially, so that the melting pot works. That's a little bit of what I'm sensing here, too. They're saying it's going too fast, too many people are now just becoming negative towards the situation. They don't want this anymore. They're turning against it. And guys like this says, we got to slow this down so that the big, you know, melting pot experiment actually works. What do you think?
Yeah, so basically, a fundamental difference, we can trace it back to the French Revolution. And this is also my take on the situation in France. Same as my take on, well, America or Sweden or any Western country that we are, the reigning ideology has been liberalism for a long time. Tabula rasa liberalism, that states that every human is a blank page, and, you know, when you're born as a blank page, so therefore you can become whatever you want. And by the way, the transgender thing that is going on, that's a logical conclusion of liberalism, in my humble opinion. So if an African can become European, then a man can become a woman, according to their worldview. So for them, hardcore liberals, they've grown up as liberals. That has been the major religion in the West for a long time. Now, for a Frenchman who's been on that side, because the conflict between royalists and liberals in France, perhaps it isn't so visible anymore, but it's been a massive scar on the soul of France for over 200 years. And for them to then say, yeah, we were wrong, liberalism isn't actually a good thing because of biology, because humans are, you know, we're born with very many pages of our book. 99 pages are already filled out with, you know, blood memories, genetics, everything like that. Then we can write the last page maybe and give over the book to our children, who then also they start with 100 pages and can fill out the 101st. So for them, all of these liberals, including Ulf Kristersson, to admit, all of these third world immigrants, they can't fit into European society because tabula rasa is a lie. I mean, that would be the equivalent of a hardcore Christian to say that Jesus isn't divine or something like that. It's a massive thing to acknowledge. So I think that is the main thing for them, just an ego thing born out of their loyalty to liberalism, basically. And I think that can explain so many things. And of course, it's a big step for even a conservative to say, yeah, I was wrong. Tabula rasa, liberalism, it's not a thing. It's not real. So I think that is, and then of course, here we come into the metapolitical, like you have been doing for a very long time, like I've been doing for a few years now, that we just keep hammering this point that, you know, race is not a societal construct, but society is a racial construct. That is just a point we need to keep hammering in. And when that becomes a truth again that we can all agree upon, which, I mean, most normal individuals, most sane individuals, they understand with perfect clarity. Then you have some hardcore white liberals. They do not acknowledge it. But if we can, you know, just show that that race isn't skin deep, you know, the most differences are in the brain, how we view ourselves, how we view others, how we treat others, such a thing as empathy, such a thing as conscientiousness. I'm not even talking about IQ levels, because I don't think that's super interesting. I think the interesting things when it comes to cognitive differences between races, empathy, conscientiousness, low time preference, impulse control, all of these things.
Temperament, right?
Exactly. So then we know that, you know, for if you have a place such as Iceland, you can have basically a libertarian society, because you don't need a hard hand, because people are, they're policing themselves, because for a Northman, nothing is worse than shame.
Yeah.
So your own sort of sense of glory, honor, and shame, those direct your life. But for a population that doesn't quite share the same metaphysical underpinnings of his worldview, then you might need a harder hand. And, you know, conservatives, they point to Islamic countries, they say, oh, how tough they are, how bad Sharia law is, but that's quite arrogant, because Sharia law, it has, you know, it is there for a reason.
Yeah.
They have tough laws for a reason, because they need to have tough laws. And I, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that Islamic countries are good, but I'm saying that in those situations, they have adapted, they have embraced these laws, these cultural norms for a certain reason. We haven't needed to for other reasons. We have different norms for different reasons that can be traced back to biology and history and everything like that. So if we can present an image to all of these liberals, and I'm including conservatives here, so I'm talking about liberals from the 1700s, so tabula rasa liberals, that we need to present them. Here is a book of this individual. It goes on for 1,000 pages. The last page you can fill out yourself, but the story is basically already set. Then you have spectacular individuals, of course, someone like Napoleon. He writes 50 pages of his book. So of course you can change destiny. I'm not a determinist in any way. I'm a firm believer in free will, but I'm also saying that when we look at averages, which we need to do when we're talking about politics, we can't just look at individuals. Then we need to look at, you know, the background, the biology, everything like that. So I'd say that can explain so many things. The liberal narrative of society, it needs to go.
For Ulf Kristersson, the PM in Sweden, isn't this more about just a survival instinct now kicking in, because he's realizing he's being there's other up and coming parties, Sweden Democrats. We can talk about the Alternative for Sweden later. There are some issues there too, problems right now. But you know, they're gaining more and more traction, And for a liberal that's not tied to like a political position like him, or being in that position where he's like, you know, we want to be the head of a party, or he wants to be prime minister, whatever. For them, maybe they can go on with their cult, their religion of liberalism much longer. This guy is kind of doing it just out of self-preservation in a way. Like, okay, I'm seeing what's happening. It's like I'm not going to be in this position and have any political power if these trends continue, because we're seeing clearly how quickly the Sweden Democrats have shot up. It's only, 13 years, basically, since they came into parliament. It became, got seats there. So that's extremely quick. And so for him, he has to kind of adapt to this, which is good, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if we can have politicians changing their tune, if they can at least start restricting immigration and thinking about repatriation or taking care of illegal immigration. These are all positive trends that needs to happen, and we need to go in this direction. We need something to happen, even if it's not like the final fix to the situation, which I don't think politics is, frankly. But we need, kind of like you said before, right? We need those small victories, even for morale, right? To feel that it's going in the right direction. I feel, even like reading things like this, I know it's like, okay, this might not change much, but I still get, you know, a little kick out of it. Like, look, they wouldn't have said this just maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and now they're forced to recognize this. They're conceding our our worldview is slowly seeping into these people's realities, and they're realizing that they can't live in this dream fantasy world anymore.
Yeah, definitely true. And this is also such a massive victory, just them recognizing first and foremost that unlimited mass immigration is bad. Now, of course, it's laughable for all of us to have to recognize that. Everyone should be able to understand. But in Sweden, for a long time, if you even said, I think we should have a reasonable immigration, okay, then you were a hardcore fascist, basically, who was really hateful of others. So that shift has already occurred, that you can say now that I want to limit immigration. Then, of course, for us, we need to start talking about active re-immigration, so deporting people who have misbehaved and etc. But that particular victory, so can say that we have taken that step. Now the next step is to get people to understand why they can't fit in and why these individuals are acting in this way when they come here. And then also, of course, I know in Denmark they did something there that they basically stole a bigger party basically stole the immigration platform of a populist nationalist party to great success. And I mean, that's it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter in a way, right?
Yeah, exactly. No. It can be the Sweden Democrats, it can be the Moderates, it can be whomever, as long as they start getting Sweden back in a good shape.
And as long as they stick to it, that would be the big issue, right? I can understand you don't trust the news, you know, a snake shows up and just, you know, tries to weasel his way into a situation. But as long as they stay to it and stay true to that, then it's fine. But if they start backtracking, then it's a problem, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Something else I thought to mention, that Moderaterna, the Moderates, and the Sweden Democrats, I think they understand this with perfect clarity, that they know they have this mandat period, these 4 years, maybe next. But if they don't start dealing with leftist corruption, they will not win. They will not win another election because of demographics, basically. So they need to start dealing with that. And I do believe that's a good first step that they are actually doing, that they're looking at social democratic, you know, dodginess, I don't find a better term, but I don't want to call it necessarily direct corruption, because that's an allegation I'm not willing to make, but sort of things that perhaps they aren't illegal, but they also don't want to be brought to light. So I think the Sweden Democrats and the Moderates, they are playing it for the long run, and first on the agenda is to clear out a lot of dodginess, to put it like that. Then they can start to implement policies that will actually make Sweden better, such as, you know, tougher crimes. Because now, in the Swedish deep state, if we can call it that, we have many individuals, many older Swedish women, who are the most fundamentally religious leftists. So we can, you know, to take the comparison with early Christians who went around defacing pagan statues with that religious fervor in their eyes, just hell-bent on changing society. The equivalent now, older, we call them batik hexor.
Yes, tie-dye witch. Tie-dye witch.
Yeah, exactly. We have those individuals who are, you know, they don't care if some criminal gang is shooting up whatever it might be, because they're,
I think,
still
they get a kick out of it. I think they, if that's like, if they feel that right wingers are pissed off at that or get irritated or angry, I think they see that as a win. That's what I think is. But they don't care about the order and the structure of society. They just, you know, the more chaos, the better, I think, for them.
Yeah, definitely, because in their religious upbringing, when I say religious, I mean religious, politically religious, you know, cultural Marxist upbringing. Guys like you and me, you know, normal family fathers who are interested in running society in a good way, we are the devil. We are evil. That is what they have been taught. Because the straight white man, the patriarch, he is responsible for all the world's evil. That is their foundational story. So just as a Christian of the first centuries AD, they were told, you know, these pagan gods, they are demons, the statues, they need to be torn down and defaced because they contribute to the evil. So we can see the same thing now when they're tearing down statues of white men. Same thing. So back in the day, there were pagan gods. So we are the pagan gods of the modern day, you and I, Henry.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's something. That's a badge of honor right there, I guess. But yeah, no, mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, it is a cultural revolution. It is the great leap forward. They call it in China. New terms they're using now is essentially the Great Reset, and that's all part of it. It's a you know, Christianity is year zero, right? And we have a new religion and now new cult coming in, and they're pushing the reset button again, and everything will be rewritten. I mean, look, we're facing completely different challenges in a way, and even technologically, it's all, you know, it's bizarre because you can actually now redo history. You can unwrite things if it's all on the internet, and if you're getting, you know, reading stories online, even about history, it can be changed instantaneously on your screen, you know, by artificial intelligence and things like that. So it's frightening where we are going. But the analogy is there. I totally agree. We're in front of that. We're facing a very much of a similar situation overall. So how do we deal with that? I mean, we talk about politics here, and much of me is like, you know, that's too slow. There is no political solution, and I understand all those arguments. It's some people think it's almost better to just accelerate this, just make sure that it gets as worse as possible the quicker, so that we get a strong counter reaction and stuff like that. What do you think we should do? How do we best spend our time trying to solving things? Should we focus on zones for Swedes, like certain areas, like let's move here and, you know, have as many kids as we can? I mean, I think all of the above, but what do you think?
First and foremost, I've seen this accelerationist position before, but I'm just going to use an analogy here. So you have two guys fighting. One guy has been knocked down. The other guy is above him, you know, kicking him in the head when he's down. And then you have spectators saying, oh, maybe if he gets kicked in the head some more, he will get angry and fight back. I mean, no, that's not how it goes. It's never good to keep losing, or to just take such a thing as a football game. Is it good to let the other team score a lot of goals so that your team will be more motivated to win? No, you're just putting yourself in a bad situation. So accelerating things is not good in the least. What I view it is a tug of war and, you know, a struggle that takes place in everything we do. We can talk about the erasure of history that you just mentioned. That is something that the left, they are, you know, putting a really high pressure on. You can see these historical dramas on Netflix. They're portraying Achilles as black. They're portraying you know, Cleopatra as black instead of a Macedonian Greek. So that is, you know, just one area where they're attacking us. They want to present the Western hunter-gatherers. So, you know, part of our ancestry. They want to portray them as having African features, but in actuality, they looked like us, but, you know, with dark hair and a bit darker skin than I have now, so not super dark, but they interpret that as being, you know, they present them as being Africans. So you have all of these attacks all the time, and for us, there isn't any one solution, but you just have to view it as a tug of war that takes place in basically every aspect of everything. So we need to, you know, we have individuals who are taking the political, so realpolitik, that fight. We have individuals such as you who have taken the metapolitical fight for a long time. Super important to shift the narrative of who we are, the narrative of where we're going, what is a good society, everything like that. Also important, then we have the business aspect. We need to build businesses so that we can support each other. So building a separate economy. Having children, of course, that's not the only solution. But, you know, it's good to have children. You know,
can never have too few white children, let's be honest.
yeah, exactly.
We need more folks, so get on it.
Yeah. So that's something. And then, as you say, the goal is, of course, for individuals with a sound worldview to assume political power so that we can start a large-scale repatriation. That is the goal, and it needs to happen via politics. So if we're sort of relinquishing the political fight, then we will be ruled by others who will then come out to our homesteads and confiscate our properties and take our children into custody. So, I mean, that is a fight we need to take. But in the meantime, of course, I don't want to live in a city. I want to live in a smaller society, perhaps not outright on the countryside, but in a community where I know my neighbors, when I know their children, where they know me. We all know what to expect from each other. And should something bad happen, we have five fathers ready to go out in a car with... ready to repel whatever threat. So that is something that needs to be done now, and of course for our children also to know where to go, where to not go, to have friends to go with. So you have these solutions we need to adapt now, and then for the long term, of course, changing the metapolitical, continuing to push the Overton window, which we have done now successfully, and that's why individuals in Sweden can say that I am for repatriating individuals who have misbehaved. You couldn't do that, as I said, 13 years ago without being labeled as the devil himself. So we need to continue to push that. And then, of course, the political fighters who are doing the nitty-gritty, they also, I tip my hat to them. They're doing good work. Many of them are a bit corrupt, but at the same time, if they are pushing things in a right direction, if they have their hands on the levers of power, they can actually, you know, make the decisions that will ultimately be good, then I am happy. So I'd say that there isn't any one solution. The struggle, it takes place in basically everything we do. We can take something unrelated to demographic change. We can take such a thing as pornography, which I've talked about for many years now. You know, that is a struggle any young man, it's sort of like an initiation. When does a young man cast off the yoke of pornography? Yeah, then he has overcome himself. So that is a fight also, again, unrelated to demographics, but a very important part of modern society that you have to sort of reject that side as well. So it's the struggle, it takes place absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, it's a personal one. It's a collective one. It's a mental one. It's a physical one. We need to fight on every level. And you can't fight, you know, yourself on all the levels all time. That's, you know, that's what we need, as you say. We need people in that political sphere. And, you know, there's a lot of people there, too. And it's like, you just mentioned voting. And it's like, it's over. There's no political solution kind of thing. And it's like, well, our enemies have used this system against us for decades now. And they're the ones who are passing laws. They're changing. It is working. It's working for them. Yeah. You know, that's part of course, why we need to wake up our people. We need them to understand how severe the situation is. And with that, hopefully at least, we don't have ideal candidates, and many of them are flawed, and there's, as you said, there's corruption, there's problems and stuff, but we have to keep trying. You have to keep trying to have younger guys getting into politics, you know, with a somewhat of a clean reputation and things like this, and try and keep doing it. I definitely see that that's part of it. It's not everything, and even if we got all the right politicians in place, man, do we have issues overall as a culture, as a society, the mentality as we have, right? So it's on every front. We're getting the political systems that we deserve in a way, or as some people say, we're getting the quality of the people we're getting is because we're tolerating them, right? And we're not doing anything about it. So it is our fault, so to speak. You know, there's awful lot of crimes that are being done against us, and awful lot of subversion and propaganda and all these kinds of crazy things. But at the end of the day, we have primarily ourselves to blame, collectively speaking, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, as Guillaume Fay so eloquently put it, the French themselves are the artisans of France's destruction. And yeah, it is true in Sweden as well. Of course, we can point to other groups who are working in the interest of their ethnicity, which, I mean, of course they do. Why wouldn't they? The issue is that we have many Swedes who are not working for our interests. And besides,
we're not racist enough.
We're not ethnocentric enough.
No, we're not.
And this is something I will admit that I try to not get too angry, because I want to be calm and nice and pleasant, because it's good for the long, in the long run. But something that makes me angry is the notion, just knowing how many Swedes have voted for these mainstream parties when they know, perhaps they haven't wanted to acknowledge it to themselves, but they have voted still for parties that have been for the Multicultural Health Project. Now, I'm not going to dwell upon it, but also, yeah, it is something to be said. Many Swedes, they have voted for policies that have been catastrophic, and that's, you know, we need to keep it in mind going forward. Now, thankfully, many Swedes have started to wake up, so to speak. But yeah, we have a lot to work on ourselves.
Oh yeah. Definitely. For sure. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back in part two here with the Golden One, Marcus Folin. Give us some of your website, of course, thegoldenone.se, but I mentioned it in the intro. You have a clothing line, Legio Gloria. You have a supplement line. I think that's both in Swedish. And is it an EU site? Do you sell any of this in the US? Tell us about it.
Yeah, sure. So the clothing line is my main heart project. I am trying to channel the spirit of Hugo Boss as a clothing designer.
Nice.
I'm very happy with the progress here. And then, of course, yeah, the supplements, we do have a Swedish page, jotunheimnutrition.se, and an EU page, which is the same address but with a .de, so jotunheimnutrition.de. And then in America we have a smaller operation, jotunheimnutrition.com. So yeah, sell basically stuff I use myself. So I'm the first customer of all of the things, and then I have a big stash which people can buy from also.
Awesome. That's how it's got to be that way. You got to use yourself, what you're selling. That's how you get success parts as well. All right. So thegoldenone.se, that's the main website here. You can find Marcus on Twitter as well, of course, under @theglorioslion. Telegram. He's big on Telegram too. Make sure you follow him over there. t.me/thegoldenone. That's some of the channels. We'll have some links down below as well. But I want to continue and ask the Golden One more about, you know, the political situation. But there's some other stuff I want to get into as well, motivation, what we can look to maybe in our records and things like that for inspiration. There's so many other things, maybe fatherhood, maybe the NATO question. I got to ask you about that. Anyway, we'll take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back in part two. We're going to continue with Marcus Follin in part two over at redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership. It's only $10 a month. It supports us, and you get access to a ton of great stuff, of course. Western Warrior exclusive videos, second hour of many of our interviews. You can also sign up over at Odyssey, odyssey.com/RedIceTV, or through subscribestar.com/RedIce as well, whatever you prefer. That's some of the methods. You can also get a longer subscription if you want to get it down a little bit per month. So you get almost 35% off or so if you get a 2-year subscription. So that's a great way of doing it. We have some other tiers available as well, by the way. We have a Plus tier for those of you who want to help us out with a little bit of extra each month. We also have a producer and an executive producer tier for those of you guys who want a shout out at the end of our shows and videos. We also want to get a little bit more input from you, of course, as producers. What kind of topics would you like us to cover? What guests do you want us to bring on? Get a little bit more interactive, if you will, with that tier as well. So thank you so much to our executive producers, T. Lothrop Stoddard, V. Miller, Resin Revolt, Good Luck Lap, Jake, Red Pill Rundown, Chalky Milk, French 47, Mark Smith, No One Jeeves, President Obunga, Mongoose, William Fox, Angry White Soccer Mom, The Second Wanderer, Operation Werewolf, The Ride Never Ends, Francis Parker Yockey, Dilbob, Last Place Simp, Joseph Hart, Purple Haze, and also JP. Thank you, guys. Our producers, Mr. Walker 696, Johan Son, Leroy Dumond, Snark Pup, Eyes Open, Mr. Lemry, Yuri New, Obadiah Hexwell, Single Action Army, and George Porge. We appreciate all of you. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you to all the members out there for ensuring that we can continue doing this. If you do not want a membership for some reason but still want to support our work, you can do that by sharing our videos, our clips, our shows, and you can also donate, by the way, redice.tv/donate. So thank you so much, everybody. We're going to be back here with part two with Marcus Follin, or the Golden One, after a short break. We have a great conversation coming up here as well. More on Sweden, but we talk about some of the motivation as well. We talk about some myths and stories that we can take inspiration from. What does Marcus do? What kind of approach does he take to some of the problems that we face? What can you look at historically to take inspiration? So anyway, a lot of good stuff coming up here in part two. Don't miss it. RedIceMembers.com. Get a membership over there. You can also get it at Odyssey and Subscribestar. Keep in mind, we don't have any big sponsors. We don't have any angel investors or venture capitalists moving in. We don't have commercials or ads or anything like that. We're 100% dependent on you guys out there, and you're the only ones that are keeping us alive. So thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you on the other side of this break.